Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
My guest today is a Scottish crime writer. Born into a working-class family in Fife, she studied English at St Hilda's College, Oxford, where she was the first student to be admitted from a Scottish state school. She first worked as a journalist, then a dramatist, and in 1987 published her first novel, Report for Murder. Since then, my guest has released dozens of books, many of which have been adapted for television. She's sold more than 19 million books too and won numerous awards, including the LA Times Book of the Year and the Diamond Dagger, awarded by the Crime Writers Association for her lifetime contribution to crime writing in the English language. She has also appeared on stage at Glastonbury in a band composed of authors called the Fun-Loving Crime Writers. Welcome, Val McDermid.
Hi there.
Hi, Val. So are you currently working on a book at the moment?
I'm supposed to be working on this year's book, 1999.
Right.
But I have a novella coming out in May, which will hopefully tide readers over till I get 99 finished.
Brilliant. And so, yeah, do you always know who did the crime in your books right from the start?
Yeah, generally my starting point is knowing the broad sweep of the story, so I know more or less who gets killed by whom and why. But the rest of it is pretty much a blank canvas. I'll usually know a couple of turning points along the way, crucial scenes that will turn the story. But a lot of it is just on we go, see where these people take us and how we get there. It wasn't like that when I started. I used to plot very carefully at the beginning because I thought plotting was my weakest area. So I would write out a pile of file cards, you know, one for every scene or chapter, and work my way through them. Some people think that that's a kind of straitjacket, but I found it quite releasing. It felt more like a roadmap because you could go up on a diversion because I knew what I was coming back to on the story spine. So that worked for me for quite a long time. And then I think I just became more confident about my narrative abilities.
When it comes to sort of devising the murder and the mystery that's going to be driving that narrative forward, how do you stop from, I guess, falling into patterns that you've used before in your career or that other crime writers have used? Are you always trying to fight against cliche?
Not so much that. I'm always driven by story. What always triggers a book is that's really interesting, I didn't know that, or that's really interesting, but what if they believed him instead of her? Or that's really interesting, but if you did this, what would happen? So I'm always looking for something that's fresh and exciting. I've got a very low boredom threshold. So the idea of just writing the same book again and again and again is absolutely alien to me. And I don't think I've ever used the same sort of plot devices more than once, or if I have, they've been transformed into something different. That's why I write so many different books. I mean, I write series and I like standalones because I get bored. I can't write two books back to back with the same characters.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because you're best known, I think, for your books that where the protagonist is Dr. Tony Hill, the clinical psychologist. But you've written, you've got loads of different protagonists that you've used in different series. You know, some of them are journalists, some of them are police inspectors, some of them are members of the public and so on. What's the attraction for you of telling stories with different investigators?
Well, it comes back to this idea of story. There are certain kinds of story that you can tell with certain kinds of protagonists and some stories that just don't work with a different kind of protagonist. So some stories work really well with a private eye. Some private eye stories just wouldn't work with a private investigator. So you have to use a cop or a different kind of investigator. Essentially, when I start off thinking about a book, I'm thinking about the story idea. I'm thinking about the world it's set in. And then I'll think, who's my investigator here? Who's my protagonist? Who has agency in this kind of case, really?
Right.
And so that's why we go off in different directions with different investigators, as well as it being interesting for me to explore different avenues. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favourite?
My favourite is always the one I'm writing at the moment.
That's good.
The rest of them, I'm not thinking about them just now. Right. They can go off and do their own thing, go on holiday or whatever.
Makes sense. I read an interview with you in which you said that you can still remember the wording of a rather cruel review of one of your plays from 40 years ago. Do you still read your reviews, even at this point in your career?
I do read reviews, yeah. I think the things that fall into my inbox now tend to be curated by publicists, so I don't really get that. If there are horrible reviews out there, I'm not really seeing them, and I don't look below the line online.
Yeah,
because that's just an invitation to cruelty.
Right, good. So good old publicists.
It varies. I mean, some books barely get reviewed at all, but my last book, Past Lying, got stunning reviews on both sides of the Atlantic. I couldn't believe every single review that came in was a rave, and I was quite nice after. This is my 39th novel and still getting good reviews, so that cheered me up a bit.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I mean, you have worked as a reviewer of crime fiction yourself for the Manchester Evening News and other national newspapers. Has that ever got you into difficulties with your peers?
Well, I was lucky when I did the crime column in the Manchester Evening News, I chose the books I reviewed. So I only ever reviewed books about which I could say something positive. That didn't stop me using constructive criticism from time to time. But I think if you're being invited to review a particular book, you have to be honest about it, because a review is a way of inviting people to part with their hard-earned money. And if you think a book isn't really that good, you should make that clear in the review, I think. But try not to be vindictive about it, but to try and explain why you might be better served spending your money elsewhere.
Yeah, it's delicate, isn't it? Yeah. So, we're going to talk about video games today as well as these other things. And lots of video games have you solving, if not crimes, then certainly mysteries. Have you encountered any scenes or plot lines in video games that particularly impressed you with your sort of author hat on?
I don't know that I would say that particularly, because I guess when I'm playing, I'm not really thinking about it in terms of plotting and the narrative so much as the gameplay draws you in, and you're in the world of the game, and that's that's kind of hermetic in a way. I don't really take much beyond the game into my other life, And I have to say, I've not ever really played a game that was supposed to be centered around crime, murder, that impressed me with its storytelling. They really need to work a bit harder on sort of detecting type games to make them work.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, you've written children's books, graphic novels, TV plays, all sorts. Are you ever tempted to work in interactive fiction?
It would be interesting, I think, to do it. My colleague Chris Brookmeyer produced a video game a few years ago called Bedlam, which he did with a games company, which he enjoyed very much. And I think it would be fun to do something like that, yeah, because, you could come in and say, okay, here's the things that I would like to see in a game, and then the game maker could roll their eyes and go, that won't work. I think find what you're good at and stick to it is probably my motto.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, we are going to talk about things that you think games have done well today. So I've asked you to pick the five games you'd like to put on your ideal fictional games machine. You've picked five wonderful games. Can you tell us about the first one then? So, what is this game and why do you love it?
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was my first introduction to any kind of video game at all. I had an Amstrad PCW, which was a steam-driven early word processor. And when they made the PCW, it was supposed to be only a word processor. But of course, programmers get their hands on these things and they find ways to do all sorts of extraordinary things. At one point, there was an arcade game for the PCW called Head Over Heels, which was great fun. But
yes.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a text adventure. And it was back in the days when you moved around the world by typing in go west or go up. And if you didn't put the right command, exactly the right command in, nothing happened. And it could be incredibly frustrating sometimes when what you needed to say was jump and you were going like up or sideways, right, left. What I think appealed to me about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as a game was that it had that sort of bonkers element that the books have. Right. Things that didn't necessarily seem to be logical that you had to figure out. The gameplay was quite straightforward, if slightly complicated. And there were characters like Marvin the Paranoid Android popping up. The thing was that you were searching for, I think it was four individual pieces of fluff. You couldn't possibly know this at the start of the game. And you sort of ambled around this world, solving puzzles, meeting characters, and just generally finding your way through the game. And I'd never seen anything like this. It was distinctive, it was unique, it was quite weird. And I thought, this is going to be fun as these things develop. And so that's kind of sucked me in. And the other game I remember from that period particularly was The Leather Goddesses of Phobos.
Oh, I don't know that one.
1950s pulp sci-fi storyline. The thing that I suppose I engaged with as well is you could play the game either as a man or a woman. But whichever gender you chose at the start of the game, the final command was screw goddess. and as a lesbian, this appealed to me. You know, I thought, this is queer.
Could get behind this.
This is a world that actually embraces the fact that you can be different. Right from the beginning, I was kind of suckered into the notion that In the video game, you could assume someone else's character. You could do things differently from the way you did them in your day-to-day life.
Right, yeah, indeed. And Douglas Adams, the author of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, was he was very interested in video games and in interactive fiction. And wrote a few. Do you know? Did he write the computer game version of his novel? Do you know?
I don't know that.
I have to check.
A long time ago now. Yeah. Obviously, don't have it anymore.
Did the writing strike you though when you were playing the game? Did it stand out?
Yeah, it was. It worked. It worked because it worked within the parameters of the book. The book was the basic text for the text adventure. So if you read the books, you had a sense of knowing the kind of world you were going to be in, and it didn't sort of break that wall. It kept you within that world in its limited way. I mean, there was no graphics or anything like that. It was just a story.
Yeah, pure text, yeah. Let's come to your story then, Val. So, tell me about what it was like for you growing up. I mentioned that you were in a mining town in Fife, is that right?
Kirkcaldy was very much an industrial town. It had a big pit and it had linoleum as well and the linen industry too.
Oh, right.
So it was a town that really had industrial working town. High employment, good place to grow up. You know, on the one side, there was the sea, so we were on the coast. So there was beaches, seaside walks, places to go and play there. And at the back of the town was open country. So there was woodland and all sorts of places to explore. And for me, that was, as a child, that was just a great, sort of having a sort of perpetual playground on your back doorstep. And I was a great reader from a very early age, and we lived opposite the Central Library, where it was my home from home. I just read my way around the fiction shelves of the local library. And in sort of school holidays, my mother would pack me off in the morning with my duffel bag and my packed lunch and the dog and say, so come home at tea time. So I would go for walks with the dog and then find a quiet, sheltered spot to sit and read. So that was kind of much of my childhood was spent doing that kind of thing. I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, who lived in a village just along the coast, a mining village called East Weems. My granddad was a miner, and he'd retired by that time. And he was like the Pied Piper. When he wasn't down the pit, he loved being out in the fresh air. So he'd like lead a gaggle of local kids up to the woods and make bows and arrows, or down to the beach and teach us the names of all the thing creatures in the rock pools. So I was very lucky. I think it was an interesting childhood. There was lots of stimulation, if you like. And I went to the local high school, which, again, I was fortunate, had a real commitment to academic success, but also the sense that it wasn't enough to be good at your books. You had to be involved with other things, like you had to be sports, music, drama, and debating society. So you were encouraged to do all these extracurricular things as well. And I think that's what stood me in good stead later on, because I've always had that sense of not just being pointed down the line of just do your work. I've always had other things going on in my life.
You know, obviously the mining industry went through a collapse, I suppose you describe it, in the 70s and 80s. Was that starting to happen when you were a child? Were you aware that this was a sort of an industry that was entering its final years?
Not really at the time, although my grandparents' village did lose its pits in 1967 because they had an underground explosion and fire. 9 people died and the pit closed. And I still remember that it was like the village came to a full stop. There was no, instead of being a sort of thriving community with lots of different people, different generations of people, it really became a village of retired people, and anyone who had to get work had to move away, really. And so I saw that village die. So when all of the miners' strike trouble started in the 1980s, I had a very clear sense of what that was going to mean for these mining communities. So that, I suppose, gave me a kind of insight into what to expect. I think, you know, like there was a real sense of betrayal in the coal fields, because the industry was taken from us, but nothing was done to replace it. There was nothing, no attempt to revitalize those areas and provide other jobs for people, provide retraining. It was very limited. Places just died, communities died. And the government of the time, Thatcher's government, just didn't care because we weren't going to vote for her anyway.
Your father was a scout for a football club at the time, Raith Rovers. You know, what do you remember of that? Would he take you to matches and all of that kind of thing when you were little?
Yeah, he would take me sometimes to see Raith Rovers play, but more often than not, he'd take me to matches when he was scouting. So this would be, Sunday matches with shipyard workers and miners knocking 7 bells out of each other on cinder pitches. And we'd sort of stand there in the cold and the rain. He used to keep a plank of wood in the car in the winter for start putting by the side of the pitch so we wouldn't sink in the mud up to our ankles. It was fascinating. Well, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed hanging out with my dad. I enjoyed watching the football.
Yeah.
So, you know, it became something that was just part of the landscape of my life, yeah. Really, football.
Did you ever sort of pick out a player and advise him and say, oh, I think that one looks good?
Not really. It was, I mean, he had his own ways of doing that didn't involve my opinions. What do you know? You're just a wee lassie.
Well, and I said in the introduction that you go up to Oxford and you were the first person, I guess, from your school to do that, and the first person from a state school. What's students arriving at Oxford is in the cultural consciousness at the moment because of the recent film Saltburn, which quite vividly shows what it was like for a young person from, you know, not a upper class privileged background to arrive in Oxford. What do you remember of your first week?
I remember finding it quite sort of strange and alien for all sorts of reasons. I mean, even the food was different. I was lucky. I was brought up in a household. My dad was a great Robert Burns man, and he embraced Burns' attitudes about, you know, a man's a man for all that. that we're all equal, that you should call no man your master. And I kind of went to Oxford with no chip on my shoulder. I did not go expecting to be put down at every turn. I reckoned I was there because I deserved to be. But also, I was lucky to go to St Hilda's, which has always been a very egalitarian college. We didn't have the kind of upper-class cliques that you saw in some of the men's colleges where, you know, young men had gone from the same posh boarding school to Oxford and had their little cliques and their prejudices and their ways. That wasn't really my experience. But the big problem that I had was that nobody understood a word I said. What you hear now is what my partner calls the Radio 4 Scottish accent. When I went to Oxford, again, I came to five, I talked like that and then became what I was saying. Ken, yeah, my first tutorial, I remember going into it and started reading my essay out and being stopped like two paragraphs in and my tutor saying to me, I must tell you, sorry, Miss McDermott, but I haven't understood a word you've said. Might you begin again and perhaps a little more slowly this time? And so the first thing I had to do was learn to speak English. So just by listening to how people spoke and modulating my own speech to fit so that I could actually have conversations with people.
Oh, amazing. Right, Val, let's come to your second game then. So, this is a little different to the first one, I would say. Yeah, tell us, what's the game and why do you love it?
The game is Railroad Tycoon. And it's the first proper game we had on our PC. It was back in it must have been late 1980s, probably about 1988, 89. And my partner came home with this game for the PC, and it was graphics. It was exciting. It was Railroad Tycoon. You built a railway. I mean, that does not sound very exciting. But you had a choice of whether you did it in the UK or whether you did it in Europe or whether you did it in America. And the idea was that you started with a limited amount of capital and you chose a particular city to start from and you had to build an empire. And it was absolutely riveting. If you'd never played any kind of graphics game before, it was just fabulous. There were different engines to choose from, different carriages to choose from. And we loaded it up the first night. It was quite late on in the evening, about 9 o'clock. We said, we'll just play for an hour, see what it's like. It was 4 o'clock in the morning when we went to bed. It was very addictive, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great fun, and there was that sort of the stresses and strains of trying to run an international railroad on the screen, and it was just great fun. It was challenging, and you know, my partner and I, we had a kind of little league between us about who could build the best and the furthest railroad. And it's addictive, like so many of these games are. So many of these sort of like financial empire type games, you know, whether it's piracy at sea or an amusement park or whatever, they draw you in, and you're always trying to improve your gear and be better than you were last time.
Yeah,
and figure out I'm never going to Magdeburg again, you know, and stuff like this. So I thought it was great fun. It was great fun.
Yeah, it's pretty. Yeah, all those like business sim games, I always find like when I play them and I get good at them, I'm like, why can't I do this in my real life? Is it not that I want to be a businessman, but why am I so terrible with money?
Yeah.
Whereas in the game, I'm just so organized.
Why did I not upgrade by a diesel?
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door.
Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So yeah, after graduating, as I said in the introduction, you became a journalist, which you did for 14 years. What kind of stories were you writing at the time?
Well, I was just a straightforward news journalist, a general journalist. I mean, I covered all sorts of things. Later, I became some Northern Bureau chief for a Sunday paper, and that meant I was sort of on the front line on stories like Lockerbie and Hillsborough. But generally speaking, I was doing whatever came up that week. I didn't have a specialism. I did some investigative journalism, did some feature journalism, but mostly I just bumped along and did the news. And I enjoyed it. The thing about being on a Sunday paper, which I was for most of my career, is that you're always looking for the angle that nobody else has got.
Right, yeah.
Looking for the person to interview that no one else has spoken to, or, as I say, coming at the story from a different perspective. So in a way, although you're part of a team, you also have to be a self-starter.
You have
to look for those angles. You have to look for those people to interview. And it's not like, you know, when you see sort of a news story breaking, you see the pack of news reporters outside the courtroom or outside the home of the person who's just been arrested or has died. I always felt that if I saw another journalist, then I was busted because that meant somebody else was following the same line as me.
Right, yeah, yeah.
I spent sort of, you know, like years being a self-starter, having to rely on my own wits, as it were, and find my own stories in that sense. So I suppose in a way that was kind of training for writing fiction. I've always sort of like coming at it from a different angle.
Yeah, yeah, definitely training you to not follow the pack, as it were. You said that you covered Lockerbie and Hillsborough. Were you actually having to turn up in those places in the aftermath of tragedy?
Very soon afterwards, I was there at Lockerbie the night it happened, and I was at Hillsborough like 45 minutes after it all kicked off.
Right. I suppose feature journalists who are trying to find a different angle, like you say, often don't like turning up. You know, I've heard it said that a long-form journalist often like to turn up after everyone else has left, and then you can start, like you say, doing your own story. What was it like for you then, as it seems like you're more that temperament, to arrive right in the middle of all of this stuff?
Well, it's harrowing. There's no two ways about it. And I mean, I reached a point where I just didn't want to do that anymore. I think that kind of reporting takes a lot out of you. You either empathise with the people that are suffering from this, who are the victims, if you like, of the disaster, and that hollows you out in one way, or you build a wall between yourself and what's happening, and that hollows you out in a different kind of way.
Where?
I have friends who are still in the game and who are really good at what they do, but I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I'm not cut out for this. I don't want to be doing this. I want to be doing something different with my skills. I want to write different kinds of things. And this is not good for me. You know, I looked around at people and I worked with them, and I knew, I thought, I don't want to be you when I'm 50. So I was good at it, but I wasn't cut out for it, you know. And so I started constructing my escape tunnel. The other element that made me eager to move was the way that in the 1980s the tabloid press descended into the gutter. You know, when I first started working in newspapers, the papers I was working for were tabloids, but they were still adhering to the principle that working people deserve to have newspapers that were informative as well as entertaining. And by the time I left, I mean, I was, you know, sort of following the sex lives of soap stars, which really wasn't what I wanted to be doing with my life. So these things kind of came together, and I thought, I really need to make a break. I need to dig my escape tunnel. And I started writing fiction by that point. My first three books were published by a small independent feminist publishing house, and I knew that wasn't going to make enough of a living for me to exist on. So I had to find a new character and a new line to go down.
I will get to that in a minute, but just before I do, I wanted to ask you, because while you were a journalist, I know that you interviewed the notorious individual Jimmy Savile, who at the time, of course, he was considered a national treasure, but subsequently we know that he was a predator and all of that. Did that encounter stay with you in the years that followed as news emerged?
It very much stayed with me because, I mean, I interviewed him very early on in my career. I was just a baby journalist working down in Devon where I was a trainee journalist. And he was doing some you know, down to open some fate or other, and I managed to get an interview with him. And I was completely struck by the absolute difference between the way he behaved in public. You know, it's all sort of like, you know, laughter and smiles and, you know, the happy chappy and everybody loves Jimmy. As soon as I was in his caravan interviewing him face to face, he was so rude, so unpleasant. He'd say things like, people don't want to know the answer to that question. Here's what they want to know. And he was very hostile. And I did not warm to him at all. I came away from that, I think, it was a really unpleasant man. And then subsequently, when I was working in the north of England, in Manchester, where I was based in Manchester for a long time, we had on several occasions someone coming into the office or someone phoning us up to claim that they had been abused by Savile. And the problem was that there was never any corroborating evidence because inevitably that sort of abuse takes place in private. And also there was a real issue around, could you put these people in the witness box? Because mostly they were profoundly damaged by what had happened to them. Many of them had problems with addiction or just you wouldn't do that to them, frankly. So, you know, on several occasions, as I say, we had people coming in and complaining about this. In some cases, they'd gone to the police and the police had told them just to fuck off. You know, this is Jimmy Savile. He's a good man. Go away. And so it was frustrating. You know, we had similar things with Cyril Smith, people telling us things about Cyril Smith that we couldn't find a way to publish. The lawyers wouldn't have it. So it's just one of those things that you tuck away in your back pocket. And I did remember that years later when I was thinking about a book called The Wire and the Blood, which was about someone, and I couldn't believe I got away with it. I really couldn't believe I got away with it because Savile was notoriously litigious. Any sign that you were investigating Savile, and you got an injunction from his lawyers. So I had a character called Jacko Vance, who had a show called Vance's Visits, which was remarkably like Savile's Travels. He was a former athlete, and I mean, there was so much he had in common. But I got away with it, I think, because I described him as handsome and charming. But I kind of felt this was a story that I wanted to tell because it seemed to me that celebrity had become a shield, that if you were famous enough, then you could get away with anything. And what really triggered the whole idea for the book was that I was in the States in 1994 researching a nonfiction book, I was talking to women private eyes, and one of them told me she'd been involved in the first Michael Jackson accusations of paedophilia, and she talked to me about how the witnesses had been bought off. And then also what was going on at the same time was the O.J. Simpson trial. And before the trial even began, people were sort of standing by the side of the road with placards saying O.J. is innocent. And so I wanted to write a novel that was predicated on the idea that the great shield against responsibility for your actions was to be famous enough. Mm. And I think we're seeing that even more so now than we were back then.
Right, right. Yeah. Interesting though, you know, the scene you describe in the caravan with the disparity between the public image and the private behaviour, that's such a giveaway, isn't it? I think sometimes, right? Yeah.
Yeah, you interview people, and I mean, so many times you're interviewing people and the mask slips.
Yeah.
Sometimes just momentarily, but often more than that. You know, you go back to the office and you say, that man was horrible. And my editor goes, oh, that's not what people want to read.
All right, Val, let's turn to happier thoughts and your third game then. So tell us about this one.
We're talking about Minecraft.
Thank you.
I mean, I played lots of games, obviously, after Railroad Tycoon and things like Myst and Tetris and all sorts of other games. Leisure Suit Larry, Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places.
Oh, God.
And Lemmings. God, Lemmings was so addictive.
What made you pick up Leisure Suit Larry? I wouldn't have put that down as that.
It was there. There wasn't a huge array of games like there is now. You know, you saw that. And of course, because it came from the same stable as Civilization.
Right.
I'd also love this world building, great game, addictive. There's a story about Ian Banks that he had to physically break his disc of Civilization 4 so he could actually get on with writing his book because he couldn't stay away from it. And yeah, I totally understand that. But yes, so I'd been through all sorts of different games, and then when Minecraft appeared, it was actually my son who was quite young at the time. He was about 9 or 10, I think, at the time, maybe a little bit older. And he started playing Minecraft, and he got me into it because essentially he wanted me to be his serf. This was in the days before you got the Classic Edition where you get everything. Back in the first iteration of the game, you had to mine for anything that you wanted. So he'd go like, "Mum, we need some obsidian. Go and get me some obsidian." So we would play together. And then I shared custody of my son with my ex. And you know, when we weren't together, I missed him. So what we discovered was that we could play online, and we could communicate online playing Minecraft. So it gave us that bond of being able to spend much more time together than we otherwise could have done. And that was very important, I think, to both of us at that time. So for like, you know, a couple of years, well, that was a big part of our lives was communicating via Minecraft and building ridiculous structures, which always seemed to involve me going and doing hideous things and spending hours mining. But it was fun. And when they brought out the classic thing where, you know, you have everything available, I just thought so much of the excitement had gone out of it. It was, you know, I mean, yeah, you can make much grander palaces and cities and all that sort of thing, but there wasn't the same sense of achievement.
Right, right.
And go and find the stuff you need.
There speaks the woman who grew up in a mining village, I say.
Absolutely, yeah. You need to be a miner.
You've got to work for it before you can build the Taj Mahal.
Yeah.
I bet your son's glad that you didn't pick Leisure Suit Larry as the game that you played together over the internet.
No, I don't think you could play Leisure Suit Larry over the internet. No,
probably best, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's come back to your story then, Val. So, yeah, your first book, Report for Murder, came out in 1987. How did you arrive at writing crime fiction specifically? What was it that made you think, yeah, that's what I want to do?
Well, I tried to write, you know, the great English novel, as you do when you graduate from Oxford with a degree in English. And I was rubbish at it. I mean, I finished my first attempt at a novel, sent it around to lots of publishers who immediately sent it back. I think, as I said, I've said often, by the time I got it back, I think I was getting letters from people I hadn't sent it to, you know, saying, "Please don't send us this book. We've heard about it." But I was still determined to write. I'd come quite early to crime fiction. I used to stay at my grandparents a lot, as I mentioned, and they only had two books in the house. They had a copy of the Bible, and they had a copy of Agatha Christie's The Murder at the Vicarage. I don't know why they had it. No one's ever been able to satisfactorily explain why they had it. But people will tell you that you can read Christie if you've got a reading age of 9. And that's probably about the time I started reading The Murder at the Vicarage. And I reread it whenever I ran out of the library books I'd brought with me. And I understand now one of the reasons for that probably is it's so beautifully structured. It's a really terrific piece of technical writing. You've got an overall story of the murder of Colonel Prothero. I'm not giving anything away because you know that right from the start. But underneath that, you've got sort of 4 or 5 subplots, and they've all got set-up, development, payoff. So there's always something going on in one of the subplots to tide you over in the bits in the main story that when nothing much is happening, and inevitably nothing much is happening because time passes, you have to have tests, you have to have forensics and all that sort of. But the whole thing fits together beautifully, like a perfectly crafted puzzle. And I think that's one of the things that attracted me to it. I couldn't have explained it at the time, but looking at it now with my knowledge of craft, it seems to me to be an exceptionally well-crafted book. And also, the thing that I think Christie's seldom given credit for is that it's funny. She's got a sly sense of humour. It's the first Miss Marple novel. There's some great lines in it. At one point, the vicar is introducing us to the spinsters of the parish, and he talks about Miss Hartnell, who was much feared by the poor. Immediately, you know exactly what she was like. And so that became my go-to book. And so I wanted to read, when I discovered that Christie had written so many more books, I wanted to read those. And I worked my way really through Christie and through the rest of the canon of English crime fiction and beyond. Whatever else I was reading, I always had a crime novel on the go. My habit was fed, I suppose, when I was at Oxford, there was a really good secondhand bookshop very close to my college, Jeremy's 10p bookshop, where everything was 10p. And they had an amazing array of crime fiction. And they had a deal that if you took a book back, you got 5p off your next one. It was a really good deal. I mean, that was the sort of start of my crime library. Many of those books I still have today. So it was a love of mine. And I realised that having failed at writing a literary novel and having failed at being a successful playwright, because I just didn't know what I was doing, maybe I should revert to something where I did understand what was going on.
Right.
So I thought, I'll write a crime novel. And what really spurred me into action was that at that point, the new wave of feminist crime fiction had started to come over from America. Writers like Sarah Paretsky and Sue Grafton, Marcia Muller, Mary Wings. And I was excited by this because a female protagonist who had a brain and a sense of humour and had agency, you know, they didn't have to wait for the guys to come and sort out the difficult bits. And I thought that was really exciting. And the other thing that struck me about those books was the sense of place. There was a sense of these crimes are happening here in this place and this time because of the sort of the kind of place it is, because of the kind of jobs people have, the kind of lives they lead. And I thought, this is the kind of book I want to write.
Right, right.
And that made me get off my backside and actually do it.
Well, that's brilliant. Yeah, I'd not thought of a crime as a manifestation, I guess, of the issues in a particular town or whatever, but that's exactly what it is, isn't it? How soon was it after that first book came out that you realised you'd found your calling and that your life had changed?
Well, I realised really when I was writing that if it worked, then that would be something I could carry on doing. I thought at the time I maybe had 4 or 5 books in me, if I was lucky. Fortunately, it turned out to be a bit more than that. But the first 3 books I wrote, I thought of them in terms of a trilogy with this journalist detective, Lindsay Gordon. And they were published by the Women's Press. They were paperback originals. And at that time, paperback originals weren't reviewed. So that book sold essentially on word of mouth. Lovely booksellers saying to their customers, I think you'll like this. Librarians telling the people borrowing them, should have a go at this, you might like it. But I was never going to make a living out of that kind of publishing. And so I planned a trilogy and I knew I was going to do something different. And I wanted to push myself to see if I could write something that was way away from my own experience. So I was working in Manchester at the time and I created a Manchester-based private eye called Kate Branigan. It was very different from me in pretty much every respect. And so I started writing those, and we sold the first 2 to HarperCollins, a 2-book deal. And I remember coming back from the meeting with the editor on the train back to Manchester and sitting there with literally on the back of an envelope doing my sums and working out that if I did the 2-book deal, if I wrote 2 books a year, which I thought I might be able to do if I wasn't working full time, I could pay my mortgage and feed myself. And so I thought, I went home and wrote my letter of resignation. That was that. Everybody thought I was insane. I mean, at the time, I was Northern Bureau Chief of a national newspaper. I had a very good salary, company car, expense account, newspaper allowance. And I was just jumping off this high dive board into the unknown waters of crime fiction. But I knew I wanted to do it. And so I thought, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. If I wait, you know, I just need to do it. See, and I thought, if I don't manage it, if I fail, I'll just go back to being a journalist. I can do that. So that's kind of what happened. And I've not looked back. Everyone thought I was mad, including my agent, who said to me years afterwards, she confessed, I used to lie awake at night wondering how on earth we were going to make it work. Fine, I was fine. I had to radically cut back on my lifestyle. I had to stop buying books and CDs. I had to join the library and borrow again. And started making homemade wine.
You did?
But, you know, it was what I wanted more than anything, and I was determined to do it. And the sacrifices didn't feel like sacrifices because they were the steps on what I hoped was going to be a successful journey.
Yeah. God, that's wonderful. And I guess you had enough of having a 2-book deal. You knew that it wasn't a complete, pipe dream. You knew that there was something there, and if you could just make the most of it, then it might work. Incredible.
I also realised something quite important when I started writing the Kate Brannigan books, and it was to do with gaming, was that if I made Kate Brannigan a gamer, then any purchases of games could be written off against tax as research.
Genius.
So I started doing that then, and I've been doing it ever since, and I have a whole cast of characters who play games, and obviously I need to be aware of what's happening, in the gaming world so that I can stay current.
Brilliant. Oh, that's so good. Well, you're often asked to sit on panels of judges, and you have done for the Booker Prize as well in the UK. What do you, I imagine you're reading first-time novels when you're doing that from young writers who just like you were, trying to make that step. What are you looking for in a prize-winning book? And how do you separate, I suppose, as well, the work itself from knowing the story of the writer and having empathy for all the sacrifices they might have made in making it?
Well, I always try to judge the book that's in front of me. The temptation sometimes with prizes have got a long tail like the Booker is to say, we should have given the Booker to that book they wrote two books ago. Let's make up for that by giving it to this one.
Right.
But I've always tried to come to the books with a fresh eye and just look at the book in front of me. For 20 years, I ran the New Blood panel at the Harrogate Crime Writing Festival. And for me, that was one of the most exciting jobs to do because you get all these first-time novels. And what I was always looking for, I think, first of all, was a voice I hadn't heard before. Something about the voice of the novel that spoke to me as something fresh and distinctive and new. But it's looking for voice. It's looking for story. It's looking for some spark of originality. There has to be something I've not encountered before. And that's primarily what I'm always looking for. Good story, well told, but again with that spark that makes it stand out. Sometimes those books can be a little bit hard to get into. You're struggling for the first 20 pages or so, trying to figure out where this is going and who is this person at the heart of the story. But they reward that early effort.
Wonderful. Right, Val, let's come to your fourth choice then. So, tell us about this game.
Tomb Raider. I started playing Tomb Raider when it first came out on the PC, and I played all the games when they came out, and I loved it, even though it was... By this time, I was beginning to understand that I no longer had the dexterity of a 14-year-old boy. A lot of times with Lara Croft, you have to make the jump just right,
yeah.
And it would drive me mad sometimes. I would be days trying to do a particular manoeuvre, but I was determined to do it. And so I stuck with Lara Croft right the way through, and... I gave her to Tony Hill as his sort of addiction to the gaming world. So he played Lara Croft quite a lot.
Tax write-off.
But I enjoyed it. And I enjoyed the fact that, you had a female protagonist who was good at sort of the tough stuff. That she didn't sort of run like sort of, she ran properly, No, I do have to say that there were occasions when I thought, with bosoms like that, you are never going to get through that gap. So they were definitely geared towards the teenage boy.
Definitely, yeah.
But I liked Lara Croft because it was a combination of puzzles to solve, and also having to do these complicated bits of jumping and climbing and things.
Yeah, they sort of made her a bit less sort of like a teenage boy's imagining in the more recent games, didn't they?
In the console versions. Yeah, and I do have, it's not in this office, but I do have a posable Lara Croft figure. But yeah, I had a lot of pleasure from those games.
I'm going to ask you to narrow it down. Is there one in particular that stands out as your favourite?
Oh, I don't know. Hard to say. I'm really bad on titles. I'm bad on titles of books as well. It's well, I've got it on the shelf. I think. Hang on. Give me a moment.
Of course.
Yeah. Tomb Raider 2.
Tomb Raider 2. That's the one where she goes to Venice, isn't it?
Great Wall of China.
Yeah, that's yes. The one.
Yeah.
Cool, they don't make massive boxes like that anymore, do they, for PC games?
Well, they don't need to make massive boxes like that anymore. Then we all download.
Yeah, exactly. Brilliant. Okay, well, let's come back to your story, Val, just for this last section. So, yeah, you talked about your love of Agatha Christie there and how reading that book at that moment in your life was so important. You were asked to contribute to a new collection of Miss Marple short stories, I think, a couple of years ago. How did that feel to get that call? Were you excited?
I was very excited because, I mean, it felt like I could kind of pay back some of the debt, if you like. So I in fact, wrote a short story called The Second Murder at the Vicarage as a sort of tribute to that.
A sequel.
The sequel, yeah. That moment where I first fell in love with the genre. And I enjoyed it. It felt like, let's say, something I could do that was a wee bit of paying back.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you knew Miss Marple very, very well as a character, but did you have to do any thinking or did you just immediately inhabit that character?
It was quite easy to slip back into that world because I was using Christie's characters, if you like, mostly people that had already been in the book. So I just refreshed myself on this. It was a good excuse to go back and read two or three Miss Marples and get myself back into that. And of course, it's in the voice of the vicar again. So
yeah.
Gave me a chance there to be a little bit funny as well in places. I hope it's funny in places. Yeah,
wonderful. So, I mean, I know it was, on the whole, a positive experience, but you did have a bit of a run-in with the Agatha Christie estate, I believe. Do you want to tell us about that? What happened?
Yeah, well, over the years, many reviewers and interviewers have referred to me as the Queen of Crime. And my publishers, not unreasonably, have quoted that on book jackets. I never called myself the Queen of Crime, and they never directly called me the Queen of Crime, but other people have. And then we got a cease and desist letter from the Agatha Christie estate saying, you must stop referring to Val McDermott as the Queen of Crime because we have trademarked Queen of Crime to reply to Agatha Christie, which is complete nonsense, really. I mean, ridiculous. We were not entirely thrilled by this, and I'm afraid I kind of took the piss out of them a little bit.
Fair enough.
It got a bit boys out of the pram kind of thing, but they eventually backed off. I think they realised that they were making themselves look a bit ridiculous, and they backed off, and everything's fine, and we're all happy.
That's good.
Now, so they're not going to take legal remedies against us. But I now have, when I'm singing with the band, I now have a new T-shirt which says, Val McDermott, Quine of Crime. Quine is a good Scottish word meaning a woman.
A loophole.
Yeah, it's the space you occupy between sort of being a young lassie in her teens and a crone. I'm a quine.
A quine. Is that Q-U-I-N-E?
It is, yes.
It is, all right, okay. I've not heard that word before.
Well, everybody's happy now.
I wanted to ask you this, you might not want to talk about this, so just say, and that's fine. But, you know, you are quite an outspoken person and that can put you in vulnerable situations sometimes. And I think a decade or so ago, you had a difficult encounter at a signing when someone poured ink over you. Can you talk about what happened there? I don't want to take you back to a difficult thing if you'd rather not, but...
I was doing an event in Sunderland and a person hung back to the back of the queue and asked for a book to be signed and threw a bottle of ink in my face.
Right.
Which was quite terrifying in the moment because, you know, suddenly I couldn't see. My mouth was full of something. I didn't know what it was. I mean, it was, as it turned out, water-soluble printer ink, but it could have been so much worse. It was scary at the time. And it turned out to be because I'd written a non-fiction book in 1994 about real women, private eyes. And one of the things I'd asked the woman that I was interviewing was, is there one case that sticks with you? And at the time, I was talking to someone from Sunderland, and she told me about a particular individual the person I was interviewing had started off as a police officer, and then she'd become a store detective, and now she was a private eye. And she said that at every stage of my career, I crossed paths with this person in various criminal roles. And so I put this in the book, and 20 years later, a friend of this woman said, oh, I just got this book out of the library and you're in it. And she didn't like the fact that she was in it. And because she came from described to me by a police officer as a prominent crime family in the region.
Right.
Her immediate response to that was not to have a conversation with me or to write a letter saying, how dare you write these things about me? It was to come to my event and throw a bottle of ink in my face. And it was very unpleasant. And she was prosecuted. She has a lifetime injunction from coming within, I think it's 100 yards of me.
Did that change your relationship with public appearances? Did you have to take some time out of that?
No, I didn't take time out. I was determined I wasn't going to be separated from my readership by that. I mean, I think, you know, one incident, in as it was at that point in 20 years, was not enough to make me go undercover, as it were. Yeah. But I do have, I do keep a closer eye, I suppose, on signing cues now. I'm wary of seeing if there's anybody who looks a bit out of the ordinary, bit difficult. And, you know, my publisher certainly and booksellers know about the story. So I feel protected, if you like, in the widest sense.
Yeah, you've got people looking out for you.
Yeah, I have people looking out for me. And I suspect these days, if it was to happen now, the queue would turn on them. But it's my encounter with readers has been, with that one exception, has always been good.
Right, Val, let's come to your fifth and your final game. Tell us about this one.
Well, Assassin's Creed. I think it's a long-standing franchise, and it's you know, got all sorts of things going for it. The early ones where you could literally go to a place and recognise it from having played Assassin's Creed there. You know, I remember a friend of ours with our teenage son, we were in Italy and went to Monte di Gioni, and he said, just round the corner here is such and such, and we're going like, how do you know that? It's because I've climbed it. In lockdown, you know, we were all kind of trapped in our homes and very claustrophobic. Getting out for an hour a day just wasn't enough. And for those of us who, you know, work from home anyway, it felt very restricted. So for me, the great joy of Assassin's Creed, Odyssey, and then ultimately Valhalla, were that it basically knocked down the fourth wall in your living room, big screen, out into the countryside, on the ocean, fresh air. And it felt like you were getting out of the house into another world. And it's a good game. It's got it's a big open world, lots to do, lots of encounters to have, lots of fighting to do, and getting rid of all your frustrations that way. And just building the character and building your village and building your community. And I thought it was a great game, particularly Valhalla. I played Valhalla all the way through more than once. And it probably kept me sane during the lockdown years. My partner had the same result with Red Dead Redemption.
Yes.
You know, galloping through the Wild West, and I was sailing through the rivers of medieval England. But it had the same, that did that same thing of sparing us from the claustrophobia.
Yes, I think lots of people had that experience during lockdown, for sure. How do you divide up who gets the TV, or do you sit side by side with two televisions then?
I don't think that would work very well. I mean, it tends to work because we both work from home, and Joe's actually goes out to work sometimes, and I go away to work sometimes, so we kind of work it in shifts. You had the console this afternoon, I've got it this evening. We're quite fair with each other about it.
Excellent. Brilliant. All right, Val, well, let's go through your console. So we've got the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Railroad Tycoon, Minecraft, Tomb Raider 2, and Assassin's Creed Valhalla. Brilliant. What a great console.
That's keep me going for quite a while.
Yeah, really well. Yeah, lots of different experiences there. Yeah. we need a name for your console to market to the world. Have you got any ideas of what you'd like to call it?
I think I'd call it the Magic Box.
Magic Box. Brilliant.
To teach out of your normal run of life. It's like a magic wand.
It's going to be a bestseller. Another bestseller for you.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Oh, it's been so lovely to talk to you, Val. Just before I let you go, one last question. You know, we have lots of young writers listen to this podcast. So have you got any advice for them who are particularly interested in becoming a crime writer? How might they go about replicating some of the, you know, success that you've enjoyed in your career, do you think?
I think persistence is the thing. You probably won't strike it lucky with your first novel. You have to be patient and you have to be persistent. And don't give up. Just keep doing it. The more you do it, the better you get. Imagination is like a muscle. The more you exercise it, the stronger it gets.
Ah, wonderful. Val, thank you so much for sharing your concert with us and your story. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much to my guest, Val McDermid. What an absolute treat that was to speak to her on For My Perfect Console. Val is, of course, just an absolute force of nature in the crime writing world. And, you know, I think a lot of people know that she plays video games, but not everyone, certainly. And so it was just great to hear her talk about that side of her life as well as everything else that we covered in that chat. Yeah, just brilliant. I very much enjoyed how Val referred to the game Railroad Tycoon as a graphics game, by contrast, of course, to her previous choice, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which I suppose she would describe as a text game. So I thought that was sweet. Yes, I did ask Val in that conversation whether she knew if the author Douglas Adams had written the text for the interactive version of his novel, and Val wasn't sure, so I went and looked it up, and yes, in fact, Douglas Adams was intimately involved in the creation of the video game version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He, in fact, co-designed it with Steve Moretzky. Now, Steve Moretzky is a name that will be familiar to long-time listeners of the podcast, because he was the designer behind the game A Mind Forever Voyaging, which has been picked by two of my previous guests, Sam Barlow, the creator of Her Story and many other pioneering games that sit interestingly between video game and movie, and then Josh Schur, who was one of the designers and animators on The Last of Us Part 2 and on the Uncharted series. They both picked Steve Moretzky's A Mind Forever Voyaging. And you should go back and listen to those episodes if you haven't. So yeah, how interesting to know that Steve and Douglas Adams worked together on this game. I did look up Steve. He's still around. It's not immediately clear on how I might get in contact with him, but yeah, I might see if I can get Steve on the podcast. That'd be good, wouldn't it? I do have as well a friend of Douglas Adams on the podcast. I've already recorded with him. They were at the same agency back in, I guess, the 1970s when they were both coming up. And he talks about that. I won't spoil who that is. But yeah, you've got that to look forward to, more Douglas Adam content. He, of course, one of his games was picked in last week's episode with Patrick House, who picked his game Bureaucracy. So, oh, interesting, isn't it? It's all linking together. But anyway, Douglas Adams, very interesting individual when it comes to interactive fiction, I think. As well, I loved hearing Val talk about playing Minecraft with her son when she had separated from her previous partner. Val was describing how she would use Minecraft as a way to connect with her son, and they would play together either remotely over the internet or together, I guess, when they spent time together. It seems like a good recommendation here to drop in that my dear friend Keith Stewart, the novelist, who also writes regularly about video games for The Guardian and was editor of the games section at The Guardian for a long time and still deeply involved there. His first novel, A Boy Made of Blocks, is about exactly that, about a father who connects with his son through Minecraft. And I believe Val, in fact, gave him a blurb for that book. So there's some sort of link there between Keith and Val. So, yeah, if you haven't read A Boy Made of Blocks, you should go and do that. Terrific novel. And, yeah, very resonant with what Val was talking about there. Okay, thank you so much for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to get in contact with me, you can do so at myperfectconsul@gmail.com. Please do send in your thoughts for guests, suggestions for guests. Lots and lots of you have done that over the months and have been booking in guests. In fact, Val McDermid was recommended to me several months ago by one of the listeners. So yeah, we've got Chris Dillon to thank for his recommendation. Thank you, Chris. If you have people in mind who you know play games, who are passionate about them, who might have interesting things to say about them, please do. Yeah, drop me an email. Let me know who you think should come on. Chris Dillon, you could also be like him in the sense that he is a Patreon supporter. So if you head to patreon.com/myperfectconsul, you can become a Patreon supporter. You can follow the podcast on there just for free and you get certain updates for that. But if you become a full proper supporter and, you know, pay a little bit each month, which helps to keep the podcast going and keep it sustainable, then you can get your episodes early and ad free. You get previews of who all the guests are coming up in the month to come. And you also get access to the new feature that we've just launched, which is My Perfect Game of the Month. So you may recall that we are all playing through the month of March 2024. We're playing through the game Factorio, which was one of Yoshinori Kitase's 5 game choices. Yeah, so if you want to join that, it's not too late to jump in. You can grab Factorio. It's on Nintendo Switch. It's on the Steam and PC. It takes a little while to get into, but once it gets its hooks into you, oh my gosh. And I will be discussing the game and my experience of it with previous guest of the show, Glenn Moore, the wonderful comedian Glenn Moore. We're going to be doing a special episode where we discuss the game and also fold in some of your thoughts that have been shared on the Patreon. So if you'd like to listen to that, you'll need to become a Patreon supporter. Head to patreon.com/myperfectconsul. I think, you know, it's a pretty fun thing to be involved in. But of course, even if you don't want to become a supporter, you can still play along with the game and you can, as a free member, contribute your own thoughts and just join in. Next month's guest, we have got Abhi Swaminathan. I think he generally goes by Abhi, though, just a sort of single name like Beyonce, Madonna, all of those, and Abhi. Abhi is the game developer and the founder of Visai Games, which you may not have heard of the studio, but you've probably heard of their game because it was a big hit last year, Venba, a wonderful narrative cooking game about an Indian mother who comes to Canada with her family in the 1980s, and you cook the dishes and the story unfolds in a really wonderful way. Abhi is a young chap, very interesting programmer, but also an artist and, you know, creative person. And we talk about his experience of leaving India, going to Canada, trying to strike out as an indie game maker. And then, you know, I suppose slightly against the odds, having this huge indie hit. The LA Times described Venba as alternately heartbreaking and heartwarming. It's a wonderful game. Yeah, if you would like to, why don't you go and play that game this week if you haven't played it yet? I think it's available on all the consoles and on PC as well. And if not that, you can at least watch a walkthrough on YouTube for free. And then you'll be fully up to speed with when we discuss Venba in next week's episode. Okay, that's quite enough from me rabbiting on. I will be back again next week with Abhi, with his 5 games, and with one more perfect console. Till then, have a great week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.